Hello, and welcome to Talking Opinions. I am Anthony Livingston Hall. Pope Benedict shocked the world in February 2013 when he became the first pope in 600 years to abdicate. Many commentators likened him to a captain abandoning ship, which in this case was a church, sinking under the weight of unspeakable scandal. But I was more forgiving. I reasoned that, if harbouring a paedophile priest did not disqualify Benedict from being elected pope, no scandal could force him to abdicate. This is why I commented that his was nothing more than the sensible, responsible, and admirable decision of a tired old man who saw no reason to abide the fiction of papal infallibility. Cardinal Mario Bergoglio then shocked the world in March 2013 when he became Pope Francis. Many commentators likened him to a Latter-day Jesus Christ, coming in to kick out all who had turned God's house of prayer into a den of iniquity. But I was less reassuring. To be sure, I readily acknowledged that his Jesuitical training would compel him to afflict the conscience, if not cramp the lifestyles, of many in the Vatican. But I reasoned that church leaders worldwide had simply become too vested in their opulent lifestyles, complete with luxury apartments and chauffeured limousines. This is why I concluded that cardinals would be even less willing to follow this pope's instruction with respect to self-sacrifice than lay Catholics had been to follow any cardinal's instruction with respect to contraception. Mind you, Francis was only doing what Jesus would do, yet few, if any, cardinals were willing to follow him the way disciples followed Jesus. But their unwillingness only betrayed just how far leaders of the Catholic Church had strayed from their holy mission. To be fair, though, the Catholic Church of this 21st century has nothing on the Catholic Church of centuries past. In fact, anyone who knew anything about papal history, or had merely seen season one of The Borgias, knew or should have known that no paedophile or financial scandal was sufficient to force Benedict to abdicate. This was thrown into stark relief in 2012, when international headlines warned that the Vatican Papers would shake the foundations of the Vatican, much as the Pentagon Papers did those of the Pentagon. The implication was that the papacy of Pope Benedict could fall. As it turned out, though, revelations in those Vatican Papers paled in comparison to the violence, nepotism, and hedonism that characterized not just the papacy of Pope Alexander of the aforementioned Borgias, but that of Pope Stephen of the infamous Cadaver Synod, Pope Leo of the Machiavellian Medicis, and many others throughout the history of the Roman Catholic Church. Apropos of which, in the Divine Comedy, Dante had Pope Nicholas already burning in hell, and he quite rightly reserved places there for Popes Boniface and Clement. Of course, some of the more demonic popes committed their papal sins after the Inferno. Still, Dante committed a glaring sin of omission by failing to also damn to hell Benedict's namesake, the thrice-reigning Pope Benedict IX. After all, he was an open and notorious sex fiend of such renown that a noted historian deemed him a demon from hell in the disguise of a priest, which on second thought, I suppose is probably why Dante saw no point in wasting precious ink on him. But I digress. The point is that his predecessors set such a low bar for papal conduct that I could conceive of no sin that would compel Benedict to abdicate. On the other hand, his frailty was such that I thought he would be 6 feet under within 6 months of abdicating. But Benedict has turned out to be even more resilient than the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Even so, my cynical take on papal infallibility is proving far more prescient, because only disregard for it explains Benedict reportedly chafing as he's forced to sit quietly in prayer, while Francis commits what he considers, in his Papa Emeritus opinion, all kinds of religious and liturgical transgressions. Francis is arguably the most humble pope in history, but his humility has its limits, because he clearly draws a red line when it comes to invasions of his space. In fact, the world got a glimpse last New Year's Eve of the wrath any such invasion provokes. That's when cameras caught him as he whacked an over-eager supplicant on a receiving line in St. Peter's Square after she held the hem of his garment for too long. This is why the church seems headed for the kind of schism not seen since, well, the great papal schism of 1378, when, as Christianity Today describes it, two popes vied for supremacy. According to Linda Telford, author of Women in the Vatican, Female Power in a Male World, the schism afoot stems from the fact that Francis is attempting to emulate the late Pope John Paul II by ensuring that practices like contraception are allowed within the church without prejudice. The problem is that Benedict is the de facto pope for conservatives within the Vatican who do not want to see such liberal ideas as part of a new Catholicism mandate. When asked whether Francis would be able to implement liberal reforms to secure his legacy, Telford replied forebodingly, "Only over Benedict's dead body." This is not the forum to delve into this schism, but I feel obliged to confess that I know far more about the East-West Schism of 1054 than the Great Papal Schism of 1378. In any event, the Elizabeth Mary Schism of 1547 might serve as a better analogy, not least because it has been dramatized in many more relatable forms. Never mind allowances that have to be made for the liberty popular movies like Mary, Queen of Scots take with historical facts. But given the church's sordid history, it is arguable that words like paparazzi and propaganda are the demon spawn of the papacy. You know, like that other P word that now has the church living in purgatory. But talk about taking liberties with facts. Both sides in this Benedict Francis schism are spinning and trolling so effectively, it's impossible to tell fact from fiction. Whatever the case, Benedict seems hell-bent on giving Francis a just cause to commit him to a lifetime of monastic silence, in effect under house arrest, just as Elizabeth effectively did with Mary. Unfortunately, such a move seems necessary for two reasons. One, to prevent Benedict from continually pontificating on seminal issues like priestly celibacy, no pun intended. But Benedict reportedly feels compelled to do so, to prevent Francis from committing the fashionable error of ordaining married men to make up for shortages of parish priests. Moreover, one can hardly blame Benedict if he continues to pontificate. After all, despite this glaring invasion of his space, Francis deferred to Benedict on this proposal, much to the dismay of liberals in the Vatican and women worldwide. And two, to prevent Benedict from continually presenting clear signs of the dementia that might have triggered his abdication. For example, in the months before that fateful event, Benedict proclaimed that he had dissolved the gay cabal that was perverting the church's holy mission. Except that this made about as much sense as President Trump insisting way back in March that he had defeated COVID-19. This is why it behooves Francis to act with deliberate speed to silence Benedict for both their sakes. Granted, some might think he's already trying to rid himself of this meddlesome Pope. Only that explains the provocatively progressive decree Francis issued last month, which calls for legislation to protect same-sex couples, because it's a wonder that didn't cause Benedict to suffer a fatal heart attack. After all, this would overturn the defiantly conservative decree Benedict issued in 2003, which stated that respect for homosexuals cannot lead in any way to approval of homosexual behavior or to legal recognition of homosexual unions. You see, Benedict believes that granting homosexuals the same marital rights as heterosexuals is tantamount to approving deviant behavior. Yet, here was Francis calling for the church to grant those very rights. Unsurprisingly, Vatican flacks rushed to issue a statement, trying in vain to reconcile the irreconcilable differences between these two papal decrees. Unfortunately, they came across like despairing kids, trying in vain to assure friends that their parents are still happily married, only to have their parents file for divorce in short order. Granted, Francis need not fear Benedict plotting with conservatives to assassinate him the way Mary did with Catholics to assassinate Elizabeth. The latter left the Virgin Queen no choice but to have Mary's head after 19 years of splendid confinement, but the former features Benedict at 93, so the only plot he can mastermind these days is one to dig his own grave. Again, the relationship between these two popes in the Vatican was already the cohabitation that dared not speak its name. Therefore, this openly restive conflict might just be the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. Sure enough, despite or because of Francis caving in on married priests, conservative bishops, especially in Africa and Latin America, began hailing Benedict as the sole protector of traditional church values. And so, just as the ordination of gay bishops blew the Anglican Church asunder, the recognition of same-sex marriages now threatens to blow the Catholic Church asunder too. That said, I've written too many commentaries to count on the child sex abuse scandals that have been dogging and bankrupting the Catholic Church for decades, but I've also written nearly as many on the gay cabal that rules the Vatican, much as a spy ring rules the Kremlin. I fully appreciate that homosexuals are no more likely than heterosexuals to sexually abuse children. But there is no denying that priests who sexually abused children enjoyed sanctuary in the church for centuries because fellow priests, bishops, cardinals, and even popes dared not report them for fear of having their own gay or other hedonistic activities outed. After all, some of the most senior clerics in the Roman Catholic Church who have vociferously attacked homosexuality are themselves gay. What's more, 80% of priests working at the Vatican are gay. This, according to Frederick Martel's critically acclaimed book, In the Closet of the Vatican, Power, Homosexuality, Hypocrisy. This is why I am somewhat heartened that Francis is finally beginning to vindicate the hope I placed in his Jesuitical courage when he was first elected. It began 2 years ago when he became the first pope to commission an internal investigation into allegations of serial child sex abuse. And the alleged predator in this case was arguably the second most powerful man in the church, namely Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, the Archbishop of Washington. This meant that it took some balls for Francis to investigate him, but a year later, he showed just how big his were, because that's when the investigation produced enough clear and convincing evidence of McCarrick's guilt that Francis became the first pope to preside over the defrocking of a cardinal. What's more, though, the final report on that investigation, which the Vatican released just this week, affirmed what I've been asserting in commentaries since 2005, namely that everyone, from 1978 under John Paul to 2013 under Benedict, knew of and was warned about McCarrick's sexual abuse of little children. Which, by the way, makes the Vatican rushing to canonize John Paul as a saint even more foolhardy than the Nobel Committee rushing to hail Barack Obama as a Nobel laureate. To be fair, the report attempts to acquit Benedict with a finding that he asked for McCarrick's resignation on several occasions to no avail during his papacy. The problem is that, if you believe that, you'll believe that Trump asked for Stephen Miller's resignation on several occasions to no avail during his presidency. Miller, of course, is the shady, Himmler-like character behind every racist and xenophobic policy the Trump administration has implemented. More to the point, though, while this report focused on McCarrick, it implicated the whole Vatican hierarchy for enabling not just his abuse, but his rise to the highest rank in the church, below that of the Pope himself. But it also implies, perhaps unwittingly, that there are many others like McCarrick who saw seminaries as little more than plucking grounds for young boys. Of course, you'd think everyone from popes to seminarians would fight against sodomites defiling such purportedly holy ground. Instead, they all just turned the other cheek. I have focused this talk on leaders of the Catholic Church, but I am acutely aware that much of the same can be said about leaders of every other church. Indeed, one need only look at the way evangelical leaders blithely betrayed every tenet of their faith to provide religious cover for the dystopian presidency of Donald J. Trump. Incidentally, for what it's worth, I think the world would be a much better place if organized religions became as taboo as religious cults, and in their stead, if the golden rule to treat each other as we would like to be treated ourselves became as second nature as saying thank you whenever the occasion warranted. But I gave up wondering long ago how self-professed men of God could possibly believe what they preach and still commit the sins they do, because, as the son of a preacher man, I saw firsthand why, instead of preaching for conversions, many of them had good reason to spend Sunday mornings praying for forgiveness for the sins they committed on Saturday night. More to the point, though, I had a teenage epiphany which not only explained their hypocrisy, but informed my apostasy. In short, it suddenly dawned on me that many religious leaders cannot believe there is a God whose wrath can erupt like a volcano and burn like wildfire. For example, any priest who really believed that God exists would have been too afraid to even think about, let alone commit, the cardinal sin of sexually abusing a little child. Moreover, the world would have been spared everything from genocidal religious crusades to the fleecing of poor parishioners, because no amount of praying could possibly earn forgiveness for, let alone redemption from, such diabolical sins. And surely no God worth his salt would allow his religious leaders to commit them in his holy name. That's it, and if you liked it, please subscribe. It's free. If you'd like to contact me, I invite you to email anthonyhall279@gmail.com or use the contact feature on my blog at www.ipjn.com. Thank you for listening, and until the next Talking Opinions, goodbye.